Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation and the California Healthcare Foundation, supporting ideas and innovations to improve healthcare for all Californians. On the web at chcf.org.
From Valley Public Radio in Fresno and Bakersfield, this is Valley Edition, FM89's weekly news magazine program. I'm Joe Moore. On today's show, Fresno State's logo, the Bulldog, it not only represents a great football team, it also represents a violent street gang. In the wake of a New York Times feature on the story, some are calling for the university to abandon the logo. Also on the program today, for the first time in 70 years, salmon are spawning on the San Joaquin River near Fresno. We'll go behind the scenes at Salmon Fest, and we'll talk with Peter Glick, one of the West's foremost water experts, about the $25 billion Bay Delta Conservation Plan. And finally, we'll hear the story of a Tulare County veteran who's going back to school to get his college degree. It's an uplifting story on this Veterans Day week you won't want to miss. That and much more coming up on Valley Edition. But first, these news headlines.
With these news headlines, I'm Ezra David Romero. Six key reservoirs of the Federal Central Valley Project are at the lowest point since 2009, when the state was officially in a drought. As Amy Quinton reports from Sacramento, some farmers are expecting 0% water allocations in 2014.
Dry weather has CVP reservoirs holding just 5.1 million acre-feet of water. The 15-year average for this time of year is 7 million acre-feet. Some farmers are worried that water allocations will be 0%. Chris Shearing with the California Farm Bureau Federation says if that's the case, leaving fields unplanted won't be the only problem.
We're also probably talking about a further exacerbation of groundwater problems. Folks in a pinch have to turn to groundwater and turn on their pumps when the ditches are dry, and we're already in a bad situation in that regard with respect to overdrafted aquifer in certain spots.
The CVP provides water for 3 million acres of farmland in the Sacramento Valley, San Joaquin Valley, and Central Coast, as well as millions of urban users. The U.S. Bureau of Reclamation will announce preliminary allocations in late January. In Sacramento, I'm Amy Quinton.
California health insurers say people buying coverage for themselves next year should expect a different set of doctors and hospitals than are available this year. Healthcare reporter Pauline Bartoloni has more.
Anthem Blue Cross and Blue Shield of California are the largest issuers of individual insurance policies in the state. Jeff Smith of Blue Shield said in order to keep its plans affordable next year, it negotiated with doctors and hospitals.
What we did was looked for what price point we felt was going to be affordable in the market and really worked with each provider to sign a contract at these rates. And the rates were lower than what we'd paid them in previously.
Smith says lower payments for doctors and hospitals will be offset by a larger customer base. But not all providers wanted the new arrangement. 75% of Blue Shield's current hospitals and 50% of its doctors will be in next year's network. But Smith says tens of thousands of doctors will still be available.
We still have a very broad network.
Daryl Ng of Anthem Blue Cross says its mix of participating hospitals and doctors next year will be different.
We sought to find providers who met quality benchmarks but would be willing to work with us to provide an affordable product.
But Ng says it's hard to say how next year's roster of providers and their pay might compare to this year. In Sacramento, I'm Pauline Bartolone.
California is joining a national mentoring effort intended to help women voters and military spouses find jobs. The Joining Forces Mentoring Plus program is backed by First Lady Michelle Obama and Second Lady Jill Biden and was launched in early 2012. Oakland Navy veteran Patricia Brooks worked as a paralegal and human resources director until getting laid off last year. She used the national program to train on business analytics software and says she's thrilled that mentoring opportunities come into California.
What you do is go online and get involved. Ask for whatever you need. I'm looking for services. I'm looking for someone to help with my PTSD. I'm looking for someone where I can have referral sources to daycares. I'm looking for whatever. And they're going to hook you up.
The California Commission on the Status of Women and Girls is launching the state's mentoring program, which is funded through private donations and not the state budget. For Valley Public Radio News, I'm Ezra David Romero. You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. Yesterday was Veterans Day, a day to honor the men and women who have served in the United States military. Some of those veterans are now enrolled in the Valley's community colleges and universities. FM 89's Rebecca Plevin brings us the story of a former Marine who's adjusting to life as a Reedley College student.
From the time he graduated from Dinuba High School, Matthew Walker was on a mission, and it didn't include a college education.
College was for those overachievers who hadn't done enough in 4 years. Those were for other people, hadn't got enough of that book learning in 4 years. So I was going to make a man's choice and not a geeky choice and join the Marine Corps.
He served as a Marine for 6 years. His job was to protect embassies in Greece, Uganda, China, and Turkey.
We were one of very, very few military elements on an embassy compound. We had fairly extensive job, but the primary one being security for American personnel and assets.
Walker describes that position as a double-edged sword. He's a 2005 Dinuba High School graduate who had never traveled outside the country before he joined the service.
It was really, really hard and really trying, but the rewards were without price.
He was honorably discharged about 3 years ago.
I bleed red, white, and blue. I love the Marine Corps. I miss it every day. But I joined when I was 17. I was good at it, but it doesn't mean that I have to, you know, dedicate my whole life at it. I want to try something a little bit different.
Walker is now 26. Today, he's working on a new mission. He married his high school sweetheart 2 years ago. He enrolled at Reedley College, where he's studying engineering. And he tutors other students in history and study skills.
Did you guys take the quiz today? How'd you do? Not great. Okay. You missed it. Goodness. You got extra credit on your homework assignment, right?
Yeah.
Ah, you're all right.
Walker says he wasn't so studious in high school. His mother-in-law, Kathy Rudy, agrees.
You know, he was interested in sports. He had a dirt bike that he loved to ride. He was more interested in the activities that he was doing outside of school than the ones he was doing inside school.
But Walker says his fellow Marines awakened in him an interest in learning, academia, and engineering in particular. The military gave him the life skills needed to excel in the classroom.
My military service is 100% responsible for the success that I have today.
About 120 veterans attend Reedley College, and that's the case with many of them, says Amber Fowler. She oversees the school's Veterans Resource Center.
Well, because of their training, a lot of them are very disciplined. So when class starts at 8, those are the students that are there at 7:45. I hear a lot of them say, if you're on time, you're late.
For Walker, the academics have been the easy part. The transition from the military to civilian life has been more difficult.
You know, touchy subject with vets and stuff, but I didn't realize that it was what it was, but I think that I was actually depressed for loss of identity, not just overseas, but loss of my Marine Corps identity.
In the military, he says, he had a uniform that he wore every day.
I had a mission statement, I had a purpose, I had an identity. I got out, and I kind of lost a lot of that.
Being a student, he says, just doesn't require the same amount of discipline or dedication.
You know, what's going to happen today type element, what's going to be required of me. You don't run into that as much in campus life.
Veteran students often experience that loss of identity, says Amber Fowler.
They go from having structure on a daily basis to coming home and being able to do pretty much whatever they want. So finding that structure and their place back in the civilian life is often a challenge for a lot of our students.
She says the Veterans Center provides students with camaraderie during that period.
They can meet other people that have been through a lot of the same experiences, and they can help each other to get through that difficult transition.
Walker has overcome that challenge by taking on responsibilities at home. Along with school and work, he volunteers with a local youth group and is involved with his family. He's also working toward a greater mission.
One of the reasons I went into engineering is so I can go back work for the Department of State and go back overseas, work in embassy work, because, like I said, I bleed red, white, and blue, but I like being overseas. I love being immersed in other cultures.
With the support of the post-9/11 GI Bill, he plans on transferring to a top-tier university. With Valley Public Radio, I'm Rebecca Plevin.
You're listening to Valley Edition. In the world of sports, it's not unusual for there to be a controversy over logos. The Washington Redskins and Cleveland Indians have long been the subject of protests from Native American groups. But closer to home, there's another sort of debate over the logo for the sports teams from Fresno State, the Bulldog. In this case, the debate isn't about alleged racism. It's about violence and a street gang that has appropriated the logo for its own use. Last week, the New York Times published a major feature on the Bulldog logo and the Bulldog gang. Much like the football team, which now ranks number 14 in the latest BCS standings, the piece gained national attention and raised some serious questions. Does the university profit from the sales of merchandise to gang members? And should a college consider changing its logo when it's appropriated by those who advocate and commit violence? Joining us now to talk about this story, we have Paul Swearingen. He's the host of the Paul Swearingen Sports Podcast and is a longtime local ESPN broadcaster. Paul, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Joe.
He also happens to have a friend at City Hall in his wife, Mayor Ashley Swearingen. But we brought him on here today to talk about this issue from a sports perspective because this is really an interesting story that's captured national attention. KPCC in Los Angeles did a feature on this yesterday, the NPR station there. People are buzzing about this logo thing, but it's not necessarily a new story here in the Valley. We've known about this for a long time, unfortunately.
Well, you know, I think it's just the popularity of the football team allowed a group of gang members to adopt that themselves. And I suspect that it had something to do with, okay, if we're the Bulldog gang, it's going to be easy for us to get shirts and hats and things that support our gang membership. So I don't know if it's anything more intensely deep than just the ability to get easy paraphernalia that leads to something like this occurring.
You have a good pulse of the local sports community and the Fresno State booster community and the people that you talk to out at the pregame shows and all those sorts of things. What's the response been to this article? Because I've heard varying things in the community.
Well, I think most of the response is like many of the articles that happen about Fresno around the country. It's a perpetuation of sort of a negative stereotype from people who don't understand what an amazing place Fresno is. And when you hear a guy like Kenny Wiggins make the statement that, hey, from Sacramento to Bakersfield, there's nothing but farming and Bulldog football, that's somebody who doesn't drive south of Shaw Avenue very often, you know, just a young football player. We know Fresno is an amazing, diverse, artistic, cultural city, so people pick this thing up and kind of run with it. So most of the people I've talked to, in fact, just about everybody I've talked to, said, just another article about Fresno nationwide. And it's going to happen when Fresno State and its athletic programs get popular, start doing amazing things. And so some of this is a tribute to how great Coach Tim DeRuiter and the team's doing this year.
One interesting thing, and I should note before we go any further, we did invite representatives of the athletic department to be on our program today. They declined. But one of the interesting things, back in 2008, the LA Times did almost the exact same article, and it didn't get nearly the national buzz. I don't think we were ranked number 14. In fact, I know we weren't ranked number 14 at that point. Is that just the price that you pay? The higher the profile of the athletic program gets, the more attention is paid to these things?
Yeah, it is a two-edged sword, because the New York Times also ran an article recently about Derek Carr and what an amazing young man he is. And so great publicity comes out of this. ESPN just came out and did a full access report on Fresno State that was a half-hour documentary on how great Fresno State football is, our facilities, great recruiting tools. So once your team grows like this and does something amazing, it's going to end up with some good and some bad to it. But I still think all in all, this football team this year has been an amazing marketing tool for Fresno and the Valley.
The university declined to comment to the New York Times on this article, and that sort of left a lot of people puzzled, maybe not puzzled, but this concern. It's not surprising the university wouldn't comment on this sort of thing. They want to project a positive image and talk about the success of the team, a great story with Derek Carr and some of the other fine players, Tim DeRuiter. But this is a serious issue. We're talking about violence that has affected not only Fresno, but communities all throughout the Valley. And the Bulldog Street Gang has been a major problem in this community. And unfortunately, it's made some people a little wary, at least in some places, to wear their Bulldog pride, whether it's on their back or on their car bumper sticker or something like that.
I can't presume to speak for the university at all. I'm not sure what the university's response could be to this, because if the university changed their mascot to the Fightin' Raisins tomorrow, a gang called the Raisins could easily grow up. And then, you know, so what are you going to do, change your logo? A lot of gangs use affiliations like professional franchises. You know, the Raiders logo is often tied to some gang violence, or even the Bulls. I think the response to it is you just continue to build pride in who you are and what you do. I think for Fresno, we don't want to respond defensively to an argument like this. This is why I'm sure the university didn't comment on an article like this, because I'm not sure what the university's response can be. I did read the article, and it said something to the effect that Fresno State considered changing the mascot at some point. And to my knowledge, that's not even an accurate statement. And so this idea of the article, and sometimes it's things that bother me about the media, is we have to boil things down into such a small space on a newspaper page or in a short time span that you don't get to really look at issues. And you know, you read that article and you think, my God, gangs are running. It's like a Colombian drug cartel in Fresno, and everybody's in danger of dying the second they wear their Bulldog logos out. Most Bulldog fans I've talked to, and I see them all over the place, aren't afraid to wear their Bulldog logos out. Now, gang violence is a serious issue, and we don't want to make light of it. And that's why it's kind of hard to make a blanket statement on this thing. In some parts of Fresno, gangs are very much a reality. Fresno's done a great job of dealing with it. I think the city has a heart to say to gang members, we don't hate you. We want to find out where the issues is and see how we can make your experience in Fresno great like everybody else's. And so I think that those are the approaches we take to these things, to try to say, hey, there's an issue here, but I don't think it's nearly the issue that the New York Times article made it out to be.
If you're just joining us on Valley Edition today, our guest is Paul Swearengin. He's the host of the Paul Swearengin Sports Podcast, a new venture that you have. He's a longtime familiar voice for local radio and television listeners and viewers, long time with the local ESPN radio affiliate here in the Valley. We're talking about this controversy over the logo for the Fresno State sports teams. Should the Bulldogs consider not being the Bulldogs anymore because a street gang has claimed that logo as their own, and it has really appropriated not just the logo, but even this, the whole persona of being a Bulldog. They bark at each other. They have Bulldog tattoos, all of these things. They also wear Bulldog merchandise, and that's been one of the concerns raised in this article that ran last week in the New York Times, that the university could potentially be making money on the sales of this merchandise. The New York Times cited a report from the Fresno State student newspaper, the Collegian, from 2008, saying that revenues from merchandise sales had increased tenfold between 2000 and 2008. And this is quoting from the article now. The same years, the number of Bulldog gang members rose sharply. What do you make of that?
Well, I think that's taking two ideas and marrying them together without a lot of digging into the details. What also happened between those years, I think the Bulldog shop opened around that time. Fresno State started marketing itself and its paraphernalia in new ways. And also in 2001, the football team was ranked number 8 in the nation. For the first time, Fresno with Coach Pat Hill really broke into the national scene. And I think that probably had much more of an impact on the sale of Bulldog paraphernalia than the gang issued it. Now, I can't state that unequivocally because I haven't done a lot of research into it, but I think the article failed to note there were a lot of other factors going into the rise of the sale of Bulldog paraphernalia at the same time as this gang thing. Are they buying the paraphernalia? I assume they are, and that may have some impact, but I doubt the university is using that as a strategy to make money.
There's also a number of people who use the Bulldog logo or the name Bulldog or some variant of the Bulldog logo for their own business interests, whether it's selling merchandise on their own or attaching it to whatever they do, that maybe not connected directly to the university, correct?
There are, and I think the university does have cease and desist letters from time to time they send out to people for improperly using the logos and the trademarks. I guess there's not a lot you can do to a gang to try to ask them to do the same.
So what about the idea of the logo, the mascot, the name? I know you've actually been someone who's said we should look at changing the name, but maybe for a different reason.
Yeah, in no way tied to this whatsoever. I've been an advocate somewhat humorously in my days of radio saying, hey, Every school in America is named the Bulldogs. We used to be in the WAC with another Bulldog in our conference. So I said, let's differentiate ourselves. I like the colleges that have a name that can only belong to that area. And, you know, like the Hoosiers in Indiana, the Sooners in Oklahoma. You can't have the, you know, Bend, Oregon Sooners. And so I've said at times, let's look for a name that has something more to do with Central California and the Valley. But I wouldn't let the gangs take away our football name at all. So that would be a poor reason to make a decision to make a change. And in some ways, I'm sure the Bulldog is so built into the fabric of our university and our city that probably it couldn't be changed. And people don't always jump on that with me.
Yeah. And talking about merchandising, I have a copy of the upcoming fiscal year, the current fiscal year budget. And these are projections from the Fresno State Athletic Department. The Bulldog Shop projects to bring in around $450,000 of revenue this year, maybe more with the success of the team, depending on how that plays out. And then merchandise royalties. The team fan shop online brings in all of $18,000 for the university. Bulldog Sports Properties, I believe that's the broadcast rights.
Right.
That's a significant sum. Other royalties and commissions, $274,000. So it's not exactly chump change, but you know, in the overall athletic budget, it's interesting to put it in context of a $26.3 million budget. Again, we're talking about the Fresno State logo controversy that made it to the pages of the New York Times last week. This story ran talking about the connection between the Bulldog Street Gang, which has taken over and is responsible for a considerable amount of the violence in this part of the state, and also the connection with the university. And Paul Swearingen joins us now. Paul, when it comes to the name of the university, I've heard some people talk about getting away from Fresno State, California State University, Fresno. There's been this name identity issue going back for years. Some people have actually said we should look at something else entirely.
Well, I, again, somewhat humorously at times, I've been a fan. But there was a time when Fresno State was battling some probationary issues, particularly when the WAC split and some schools left to become the Mountain West. And there were some attachments to Fresno State that had some negativity from things that had happened in our past, probationary issues and things. And I suggested and still love the idea, as a matter of fact, of calling our athletic programs California State rather than Fresno State. The official name of the university is California State University Fresno, and all around the country, in Tallahassee, they have a Florida State. In Corvallis, Oregon, they have an Oregon State. There is no California State. And a school in Texas, I believe it was Texas San Angelo, recently changed, went from calling itself Texas San Angelo to Texas State. Southwest Missouri State, a school in my hometown of Springfield, Missouri, recently changed their athletic department from Southwest Missouri State to Missouri State. There is no Cal State. There's a Cal, but no Cal State. So why shouldn't we, as the preeminent athletic department of the CSU system, step up and say, we are Cal State, and I think only enhance our ability to be a legitimate rival to our UC friends up in Berkeley or wherever else. So I've always loved the idea of saying, instead of being Fresno State, let's be Cal State. Then I always hear the argument from people like, oh, you want to take Fresno out of the name? Your wife is mayor. But I don't think anybody in Tallahassee, Florida is saying, I wish we were Tallahassee State and not Florida State, or Corvallis State and not Oregon State.
Very interesting indeed. I wonder, though, I think San Diego State and San Jose State might have something to say about that.
Now, the difference there is those two schools have officially changed their name. It's not CSU San Diego. They officially changed their name to San Diego State, and same with San Jose. They're not CSU San Jose. They are officially San Jose State, and so therefore, I don't think they can rightly lay claim to the name.
All right.
Now, if Humboldt State wants to play a football game against us for it, we'll take them on.
Looking at the larger issue right now, or the sports issue that's out right now with the Bulldogs and the national prominence, number 14 in the polls, and potentially playing in a BCS game. Pat Hill was very big on establishing all of Central California's Bulldogs territory. Our station covers from the top of the Grapevine to the southern fringes of the Delta. So we have people outside of the immediate Fresno area listening to us right now. Do you think that vision is still alive and well under this
under Tim DeRuiter and the new athletic department headed with the same folks in Thomas Bay, but a new president in Joseph Castro.
Yeah, and I do believe so. And I know Coach DeRuiter does a lot of the bus tours that Coach Hill used to do and has really picked up the Green V idea and continued to carry that forward. And so I do think Fresno State is, even though people in Sacramento don't like to claim to be part of the same valley as us, I think they are. So in many ways, I think Fresno State is the major athletic program from Bakersfield to Sacramento, and we are the Valley's team.
One last question, another sports thing that was in the news last week. On Friday, Joseph Castro, the new president of Fresno State, announced that he was undertaking a strategic review of the athletic department, looking at all of the sports, and wrestling. Men's wrestling came up again. This is a program that was eliminated about 5-6 years ago under President Welty for budget reasons, for gender equity reasons, or at least that was one of the excuses given by the university at the time. Castro did not commit to bringing back the wrestling program, but said he is interested in it, and if the community wants to step up its fundraising, he would consider bringing it back. What do you think the chances there are, and is this potentially a sticky situation for a new president to get in, especially if the money comes a little short, as it did last time? They raised a considerable chunk of money, but it wasn't enough, and the program went away.
Well, it's an interesting topic. Wrestling is such a big sport in the high schools of Central California, and so it would seem logical to have a wrestling team at the university. There is financial ramifications. If the university president gets behind it, you would think maybe that could be overcome. The problem is, in the Title IX situation that Fresno State has been battling for a number of years, whenever you spend money on a men's sport, you have to have sort of an equal response on the women's side, and thus that's the reason we have many more women's sports than we have men's sports, because football has 85 scholarships, and you have to match those scholarships on the women's side. My hope is that Fresno State has done such a valiant job at overcoming its past difficulties with Title IX that we can get some reasonableness in this thought going forward and look at ways to bring back. Wrestling should be a sport at Fresno State. There's no question about it, and a way to do it that's financially feasible, but it's going to have to work financially at the end of the day, because there is no extra pot of money lying around, and so that's going to be a hurdle both on the men's and the women's side Fresno State would have to get over.
Does Tim DeRuiter stay beyond this year?
Boy, that's tough. It's good to be in the position where the nation wants our football coach, and he's a spectacular guy, and the staff is great. I wouldn't guarantee that by any stretch of the imagination. But I still think maybe he needs to build the resume just a little bit more. But, hey, if Fresno State wins the Fiesta Bowl, I don't know if he and his staff are ever going to be more marketable than that.
Paul Swearengin, host of the Paul Swearengin Sports Podcast, former ESPN broadcaster, longtime ESPN broadcaster here in the Valley, and his wife is also the mayor of Fresno. Paul, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for inviting me.
You're listening to Valley Edition. Stay tuned. We'll be back in just a moment and find out about a new city that's planned for the base of the Grapevine. It's called Grapevine. It's coming up in just a moment here on Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio. You're listening to Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio. I'm Joe Moore. Earlier this year, construction began on a new outlet mall at the base of the Grapevine, where Interstate 5 and Highway 99 connect. The $90 million outlets at Tejon Ranch are just the beginning of what is to come at the southernmost point of the Central Valley. FM 89's Ezra David Romero tells us more.
Do you know that moment when you're driving north on Interstate 5 through the Tehachapi Mountains, when the wide expanse of the San Joaquin Valley comes into view? On a clear day, it's an impressive sight, but next time you're there, look around. Most of what you see, from the hills down to the valley floor, is part of the Tejon Ranch, the largest privately owned piece of land in California. And it's here, right at the base of the mountains, where Interstate 5 and Highway 99 meet, that developers from the ranch are planning a new town, known simply as Grapevine. Right now, it's where travelers stop for coffee, gas, charge their Teslas, and order hamburgers.
Welcome to Starbucks. My name is Rudy. I'll be your barista today. What kind of service plan?
It's also home to giant warehouse distribution centers for brands like IKEA and Caterpillar. But it soon could be the site of 12,000 homes, apartments, and condos, according to Barry Zoller, spokesman for the ranch.
It really is a long-range plan How do we develop a community that will meet the needs of all of the workers who are currently employed at the Tejon Ranch Commerce Center?
The community aims to house the 2,500 employees that currently work at the Commerce Center and 5,000 future workers in commercial developments that will be built in coming years. And Zoller says the development is consistent with a 2008 settlement between the ranch and environmental groups. It set aside 90% of the ranch's 270,000 acres for conservation. Zoller says Grapevine would be a complete community.
Plan from the very beginning to have entertainment options, to have recreation options, to have grocery stores, sites for schools. So everything's self-contained.
The history of this piece of California dates back to the 1850s.
The location at the base of the Grapevine was home to what was called Rose Station. And Rose Station was one of the stagecoach stops on the Butterfield Stagecoach Line, which went from San Diego up to the gold fields in the Sacramento area.
California, there's plenty of gold, so I've been told, on the banks of the Sacramento.
And it was complete with a post office, obviously the stagecoach stop. It had general stores, boarding houses, probably a bordello or some sort of saloon. This was the Wild West we're talking about.
Zoller says Tejon Ranch is adding to the history already present at the base of the Grapevine.
So it was always the crossroads for people going between north and south and east and west. So it's always been really a center of California commerce. Approximately 65 million people a year pass by the site. 14 million people a year stop at the Commerce Center. And another 11 million, we expect, will be stopping each year at the outlets at Tejon Ranch.
And it's this sheer volume of visitors that Tejon Ranch wants to capitalize on. Earlier this year, construction began on a 325,000-square-foot outdoor shopping mall, which will house more than 70 stores offering designer goods at discount prices. The outlets at Tejon Ranch are estimated to cost $90 million.
So what would have been considered a way station for travelers and a location for the distribution of goods will now become a destination in and of itself.
But those in Bakersfield and other neighboring cities should be a little wary of the outlets, says Kern County District 4 Supervisor David Couch.
What ought to be of concern to City of Bakersfield and other cities is more the retail side of that. All cities, they'll tell you, they're very aware of sales tax generators that will pull sales tax dollars from their communities.
Couch also says there are two sides to how the Tejon Ranch projects will impact Kern County.
You can look at it on its face and you can say, hey, you know, this is going to have an impact because you're going to have an increase in property tax, you're going to have an increase in sales tax, you're going to have an increase in jobs available, and, you know, all of those things are positive. The flip side of that is you get more traffic, you get more, all services being needed. It's not a free lunch.
He adds that increased business in the area could also add to pollution. But Zoller says Grapevine will address those concerns by
really de-emphasizing the automobile and emphasizing a more sustainable lifestyle.
He says the development will be built in a series of compact villages with bike trails and pedestrian features. Zoller says the company has already requested modifications to Kern County's general plan to accommodate the new development. But it's too early to discuss details like environmental review, sources of water, and potential sites for schools. For Valley Public Radio, I'm Ezra David Romero. Tejon Ranch is also building a 25,000-acre, 3,500-home Tejon Mountain Village Mountain Resort. Near Lebec in the Tehachapi Mountains, the approved project will break ground soon. This is Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio. Stay tuned. In just a moment, we'll be back with a story about salmon spawning again in the San Joaquin River for the first time in 70 years. Salmon Fest was this past Saturday. We'll have the story and more coming up on Valley Edition here on Valley Public Radio. Listening to Valley Edition, I'm Joe Moore. California is on course for what could be its driest year on record.
Those were the sobering words from scientists with the National Weather Service in Sunday's San Francisco Chronicle. And after two dry years, the relative lack of rain and snow is putting a great strain on the state's precious water resources. In a few minutes, we'll talk with Dr. Peter Glick, one of the top water experts in the state, about the plan to fix the Sacramento-San Joaquin Delta with the Bay Delta Conservation Plan. That multi-billion-dollar project would not only restore critical delta habitat and shore up failing levees, it would also build two giant tunnels beneath the delta to bring water from the northern part of the state to farmers and city residents in the southern part of California. Just who will pay for it and how much it will cost are a few of the questions that are up in the air. But there's another big water story in our backyard, the restoration of the San Joaquin River. That's the sound of a nearly 3-foot-long Chinook salmon being released into the San Joaquin River at Fresno's Lost Lake Park, just below Friant Dam. It was the centerpiece of an event held last Saturday afternoon called Salmon Fest, which brought together fishermen and conservationists to celebrate the effort to bring salmon back to the river after nearly 70 years. As Gerald Hatler, program manager with the California Department of Fish and Wildlife, explains, it's kind of like a salmon bucket brigade.
We're also releasing salmon directly in the San Joaquin River that we've trapped further downstream in the San Joaquin.
All to help repopulate a species decimated by a river that goes dry for about 60 miles.
There's some physical barriers to fish getting upstream. So what we've done is we're going downstream on a regular basis, picking up fish downstream, putting them in the river up here below the dam, and giving them an opportunity to spawn. And if we get enough flows in the springtime and there's enough rainfall, some of those juveniles can actually make it out. We know that they can make it all the way to the Merced River if there's enough water for them.
Monty Schmidt with the Natural Resources Defense Council says that biologists have learned a lot since last year when a smaller salmon program was underway.
Nothing like this had been done before, and we found that salmon we could move them up, and they were released, and they were successful at spawning, and we found juveniles in the river, which was really exciting.
On this day, only 3 salmon were released. But so far this season, a total of about 60 have made the trip. The hope is to bring that number to as high as 200 by December. If all goes well, they'll spawn and lay their eggs here, and then, as all adult Chinook salmon do after they spawn, they'll die. But Schmidt hopes this year their offspring will make the 150-mile trek to where the San Joaquin meets the Merced on their own.
We're actually hoping that this year we'll be able to get water all the way downstream, and that these juveniles that are produced from these adults that we released today will be able to make it all the way downstream and hopefully out to the ocean and grow and come back 3 years later as some of the first adult Chinook salmon to come back to the San Joaquin on their own.
It's all part of a $380 million restoration project which aims to repair some of the damage done to the river ecosystem after the federal government built Friant Dam in the 1940s. The dam diverted the waters of the mighty San Joaquin to make the east side of the valley bloom, but it also dried up a portion of the river and killed what was once a vibrant salmon fishery. In 1988, NRDC and other environmental groups sued the government and the Friant Water Users Authority. The parties reached a settlement in 2006, and the restoration, which not only involves the salmon, but also putting more water down the river and restoring the channel, is now underway. So what happens in a dry year?
In the driest of years, like we saw in 1977, the restoration program actually gets no water. So in a way, the restoration of the river and salmon sort of shares the bounty and the poverty of our rainfall.
Schmidt also says the restoration effort makes an attempt to reuse some of the water after it flows downstream.
Hundreds of thousands of acre feet of water have actually been captured downstream. Once it's moved downstream and it's provided the biological benefit that it can provide, then it's taken off the river and it's brought back into the water supply system and it's brought back to the farmers who would have used it otherwise.
Still, not everyone is sold on the idea. Friant resident Sean Neal says he likes the salmon restoration, but
I think the farmers are more important than anything, but I think they can make a happy compromise, and I'm hoping that logic happens because farmers need the water.
and that compromise is something that all parties seem to endorse.
There's a lot of historic uses that we're now trying to weave the restoration program together with so that agricultural uses and flood protection continue, but we can integrate a living river around it. And that's the part that takes a little more time, but you know, we're making progress.
And for now, that progress is in the form of three more salmon hoping to spawn in the San Joaquin River, just a short drive from Fresno. Reporting from Lost Lake Park, I'm Joe Moore for Valley Public Radio. You're listening to Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio. Far downstream from Bryant Dam, where the San Joaquin River meets the Sacramento, lies the Delta. This ecosystem is the source of the water for two-thirds of the state and much of the valley's agriculture. But it's threatened. Levees could fail in an earthquake. The health of the ecosystem is in decline. And farmers, cities, and environmentalists are all pointing fingers at each other when it comes to assigning blame. So what should be done? Governor Brown has laid out a vision for a massive twin tunnel project that would take water from the north under the Delta, bypassing the fragile ecosystem, and delivering it to agriculture and urban users in the south. It could cost as much as $25 billion. But a lot of questions remain. Joining us now is one of the foremost experts on water in California, Peter Glick. He is the president of the Pacific Institute and a member of the National Academy of Sciences. He recently published an op-ed piece in the Sacramento Bee critical of the Bay Delta Conservation Plan and the effort to build the two twin tunnels beneath the Delta. Peter, welcome.
Happy to be here.
You know, the Bay Delta Conservation Plan is interesting because it has both support and opposition from a lot of very different groups. You have some farmers who like it, some farmers who don't. You have some environmentalists who like it, you have some environmentalists who don't, and everyone in between. What are some of your concerns as you raise them in the column in the Bee?
Yes, I think I should probably be explicit. As I wrote in the piece in the Bee, I'm sort of ambivalent about the plan. I would love to have an opinion about whether the governor's plan or some variant of the plan that they're talking about is a good or a bad idea. But there's still a tremendous amount of uncertainty. There are a lot of things that we don't know yet that I feel like we ought to know before we can have an informed opinion about whether it's a good idea or a bad idea. You know, there are things about how much water we're going to be taking out of the Delta under different configurations. There are uncertainties about the amount of money that's going to be spent and who's going to spend it, and uncertainties about who's going to operate it and what the rules are going to be and whether or not there's going to be flexibility to change the rules if things turn out one way or another in the future. I guess the idea is that we're heading down a road without much of a guidepost for where that road is really leading us.
The situation with the Delta, with efforts to try to improve the health of that fragile ecosystem, rely on a number of different scientific things that are going on, and people are doing their best to analyze the situation. But I've heard a number of environmentalists point out the fact that you aren't going to improve the Delta by taking more water out of it. What type of potential do we have to impact the health of the Delta in the future if we are taking more water out of the area?
Well, first of all, let me say that I think there's certain things that everyone really agrees on, farmers and environmentalists and scientists and politicians, and that is that the situation in the Delta and California's water situation more broadly isn't really working. It's not doing all of the things that it has to do. What we want is we want safe and reliable deliveries of water to farms and to the cities that need it. we know that we want a healthy environment because that's part of what California is all about in the Delta and elsewhere. And we know that we don't have those things at the moment. And so we know that we need to do something in the Delta. The problem is we haven't yet come to an agreement about what to do. And part of the question, as you're raising it, is how much water should we be taking out of the Delta? And there is a lot of agreement, certainly in the scientific community, that the amount of water we're taking out of the Delta and when we take it and where we take it is causing a lot of damage. It's hurting our fisheries, it's hurting natural ecosystems and wetlands and the flyways for waterfowl, and it isn't even providing the goods and services in terms of water deliveries that I think we want. And so something has got to be done. But the question is whether what's being proposed is going to solve both the water supply problem and the natural ecosystem restoration problem.
As I've seen it described, the amount of water diverted out of the Delta over the years has continued to grow with peaks and valleys here and there based on the precipitation every year. Do they track fairly closely with overall environmental decline and the decline of the ecosystem? Is that an established connection there?
You know, that's a great question, and there's a lot of misunderstanding about this. If you actually look at the amount of water that's been taken out of the Delta, and we take water out of the Delta above the Delta in the rivers that feed into where the Sacramento and the San Joaquin join, we take water out of the Delta directly for uses around the Delta, and we take water out of the Delta in large volumes to ship to the southern part of the Central Valley for agriculture and to coastal cities in the south. And if you look at the graph, if you look at the numbers for the amount of water being taken out of the Delta over really the last half century, there's been a constant increase in that amount of water with little dips during droughts. In droughts, we cut back because there isn't enough water to deliver to everybody that wants water. But in general, the amount of water has been increasing, not decreasing. And people don't, I think, understand that. And part of the problem with the Bay Delta discussions that are going on now is that there's no agreement about how much we have to take out in the future. And there are many people who feel that the proposals that have been put forward, the big tunnels, the diversion that's been proposed, may permit even more water to come out of the Delta than now. And ecologists and fisheries experts think that's probably a mistake. Now, it's possible that less water will be taken out of the Delta, but you certainly can't tell how much is going to be taken out from the documents that are available yet. And that was, again, one of the points that I made in this piece I wrote, is that it really would be nice to have a sense of how much water we think is going to be delivered and what that water is going to cost us.
You and other environmentalists have also raised some concerns about the Bay Delta plan, saying, let's take a step back. Have we really studied all of the alternatives, and is all of that being done on a level playing field? What's your concern there?
Yeah, this is another problem. When you build a really big project of any kind, you build a highway, you build a dam, you build a set of water delivery tunnels like this, you build a power plant. One of the things that we've, as a society, have asked our engineers and planners to do is present not just the plan, but alternatives to the plan. Okay, if you don't do A, what might you do instead in order to satisfy what you want? And in this case, I don't believe that the full evaluation of the alternatives has really been presented or evaluated. So, for example, we know for a fact that Southern California cities and farms in the Central Valley over the last couple of decades have been becoming more efficient. They've been doing more with the water they already have. We've replaced inefficient washing machines and dishwashers and toilets with more efficient ones. And farmers have been replacing flood irrigation with sprinklers and drip irrigation. And they're able to do more with less water. But we haven't had a full assessment of if we really were efficient, if we really implemented cost-effective existing technology pretty widely throughout the state, could we cut the demand for water from the Delta, and I would say not just the Delta, but from all of our water systems, quite substantially? Could we reduce the size of these withdrawals and restore ecosystems with some of that saved water? That's an alternative that also I don't believe has been adequately evaluated in the Bay Delta. And that's one of the alternatives to building big infrastructure. It might permit us to build a lot smaller infrastructure with a lot less cost and still produce reliable deliveries of water for what we really want.
Given the contentious nature of water politics in California and environmental politics in California, it seems like it's going to take some sort of a coalition to accomplish something with the Delta, whether that's shoring up the levees, whether that's making a more reliable, consistent water supply for farmers and urban uses, whether that's restoring habitat. It seems like there are going to have to be parties coming together from different sides of the table, both to support this plan and to support paying for it. How difficult is it to try to hold that coalition together, to try to form that sort of coalition?
Well, of course, that's the $25 billion question. Water and politics are a volatile mix in California. They always have been and they always will be. Again, as I said at the beginning, I don't think anyone disagrees that something has to be done. We definitely need to fix the Delta, and by fix the Delta, I mean figure out how to continue to provide reliable, affordable water supplies and at the same time restore some of the devastated ecosystems from the way the whole system has been built and operated in the past. And the question is how best to do that. We don't have a real coalition, any single coalition in California. It's not agriculture versus cities versus environmentalists, because Northern California cities and Southern California cities often have different interests, and Northern Sacramento Valley farmers and Southern San Joaquin farmers, or East Side farmers and West Side farmers, or farmers who grow alfalfa versus farmers who grow more seasonal crops or permanent crops, don't always have the same interests in mind. And so figuring out that coalition, figuring out how we can satisfy everyone's needs effectively, by effectively I mean efficiently from an economic and an environmental and a political perspective, is really the key. And I think there's still too many uncertainties in the way the plan has been presented to us now. I think we need to look more carefully at alternatives. We need to look really carefully at who's going to pay for what. We need to look more carefully to make sure that we're not just getting benefits on one side of the equation and not on the other, but we are getting co-benefits, as I think we're trying to do. The BDCP is very, very much trying to do the co-benefits, environmental benefits and societal delivery benefits. But there's still a lot of things we don't know that I think we ought to know.
If you just joined us on Valley Edition today, we're talking with Peter Glick. He's one of the foremost water experts in California. He's also president of the Pacific Institute and a member of the National Academy of Sciences. Peter, I was talking with a West Side farmer not that long ago and talking about the Delta, and he said that, and I'm paraphrasing here, that it's a myth to think of the Delta as an untouched natural ecosystem. It's been heavily altered over the years, the creation of the levees and the islands and things. This is very much a man-made environment now, and he said, well, the idea that we're going to turn it back to the way it was before the gold rush is laughable. And that brings up another question. Just what would be the goal in terms of improving the health of the Delta? To what extent? What is the benchmark that we try to set?
Well, first of all, let me say that your West Side farmer was both correct and presenting a straw man argument. It's certainly correct that our entire ecosystem is been irreversibly altered by human activities, and the Delta is no longer in any sense a natural system the way it used to be before we were around. But it's also not the case that I think anyone really believes that's what we're trying to restore, and anyone's trying to restore that. That's not the objective. The objective in the short run is to prevent the worsening of the conditions there and the extinction, the further extinction of some of the fish species, the bird species, the ecosystems that are hanging on by their fingernails now. So part of the question is not complete restoration, but repairing and restoring to some degree some of the ecosystem function that's there, while maintaining the societal benefits of safe, reliable deliveries of water that are also critical to our economy. So again, it's a balance. In the short run, we have to protect the fisheries, especially the endangered fisheries, the salmon, many of which are commercial fisheries as well, that are threatened with extinction. But we're also at the same time restoring natural wetlands that provide water quality improvements. these aren't just ecosystem benefits that are separate from human needs and human society. These are benefits to all of us, and they're not just recreational benefits. They are really societal benefits. They clean our water. The more we have natural wetlands, the less we have to treat our water for further use. That's just one example, and there are many, many other examples. But over time, that's going to be a continued part of the discussion. How far do we go to restore, or how far can we go to restore natural ecosystems while still providing the economic benefits that our water system brings to us?
Your piece in the Sacramento Bee talks about a lot of the unknowns and raises concerns about, well, we just don't have enough information right now to really be able to tell what BDCP would do, what the Twin Tunnel plan would do for water users, for the environment. There's another unknown out there that I want to talk about, and that's global warming. To what degree are scientists looking at how the changing climate and changing rainfall, snowfall patterns in the Sierra would have an impact on the water that's flowing through the Delta and thus the health of the ecosystem and simply the amount of water there would be to distribute to users?
Yeah, that's a great question and a critical issue, in part because we know that climate change is a real problem. We, the scientific community, are sure now that humans are changing the climate as we are that smoking tobacco causes cancer. That's not up for debate in the science community anymore. There are plenty of uncertainties about the speed at which the climate's going to change, about the nature of the impacts of climate on our water resources, on agricultural production, on coastal developments, and a whole range of things. But we do know that we have to integrate climate change now into our planning. The BDCP is doing some of that. The Department of Water Resources is doing some of that. We're beginning to think about, all right, we're going to lose snowpack. We know we're going to lose snowpack because it's getting warmer. In fact, we already see that. That's changing the timing of when water flows through the system. That's going to have to be taken into account in the way we operate the existing system, our existing reservoirs and dams and delivery systems. But it's also going to have to be taken into account in how flexibly we design anything we build in the future. We had better start to think about integrating what we know about climate change now, because doing that is going to be cheaper than having to fix something that we've built, again, probably for multiple billions of dollars, without taking into account climate change in the future.
Looking back, one final question. Earlier this month, the L.A. Department of Water and Power celebrated the 100th anniversary of the Los Angeles Aqueduct, of course, engineered by William Mulholland and made famous in the fictionalized account in the film Chinatown. It seems like that story of Owens Valley and the quote-unquote theft of the water from that area comes up in almost every discussion of water in California. Have we learned our lessons, do you think, in California from the mistakes of that era?
Well, that's a perfect example. We're celebrating the construction of this aqueduct that took water from a rural area and brought it to Southern California to a growing urban area. And without a doubt, that aqueduct brought great benefits to Los Angeles. It brought water supply and permitted that city to grow as big as it has. But we also have to realize that that was an era with incredible political corruption, and we didn't care what happened to the Owens Valley in those days. We couldn't build that same system today with the same lack of respect for the environment and the same lack of respect for rural communities. We have to do things a little differently because we're smarter today. So I think we need to celebrate the infrastructure we have. We need to protect the infrastructure we have and make sure it's reliable. But we need to fix the problems that infrastructure brought us that we didn't know about or didn't care about, the ecosystem impacts, the social impacts. And we shouldn't only look to that kind of infrastructure in the future. We need to look to really 21st century solutions and not 20th century solutions.
Our guest today has been Peter Glick. He is the president of the Pacific Institute and a member of the National Academy of Sciences and is one of the foremost water experts in California. Peter, thank you so much for joining us today.
It's been a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
That's all for today's Valley Edition. You can hear audio archives and subscribe to our podcast online at kvpr.org. We welcome your comments and suggestions. You can email us, talk@kvpr.org, and follow us on Twitter. We're @KVPR. For reporter Rebecca Plevin, Valley Edition producer Ezra David Romero, audio engineer Marv Allen, and production and operations manager Don Weaver, I'm Joe Moore. This is Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, and the California Healthcare Foundation, supporting ideas and innovations to improve healthcare for all Californians, on the web at chcf.org.